Coming up on Tech Nation, Matt Ridley. You know him from his books, including The Rational Optimist, or from his column in the Times of London on science, the environment, and economics. Today we're talking about how innovation works and why it flourishes in freedom. Then Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft heads up the COVID-19 Response Task Force for the XPRIZE Pandemic Alliance. Companies, universities, and others are coming together. All this and more coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's Take Five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
In 2012, Harvard Medical School professor George Church published Regenesis: How Synthetic Biology Will Reinvent Nature and Ourselves. While most people understand that they and all living organisms have DNA, how is that different from synthetic biology?
Well, synthetic biology is an effort to apply engineering principles to biology, molecular biology in particular, in the sense that rather than taking random parts and bashing them together, we're taking well-characterized parts that we trust. We're doing some of the things that you do in other engineering disciplines like safety engineering and part standardization, and that's the thing that's new.
I think what's so important is that people understand a lot about computers these days. They know that they program computers and their instructions. And the instructions contained in the DNA are just four, G, C, A, and T. And the idea that now not only can we decode anything that's in DNA, we can take on a computer and type G, C, A, T, and it can create that actual DNA sequence.
Right. Computers are just two components, zeros and ones, so the four versus two are very similar. What's important when you talk about instructions, they're much bigger things. We inherit now with synthetic biology this engineering discipline of computer-aided design, where you actually use computers to design computers, or you use computers to design cars and bridges and so forth. We're now applying this to biology, where we'll try to make a particular shape or a particular regulatory sequence and so forth. There's a huge opportunity here, and I think we're meeting in the synthetic biology community of encouraging responsible behavior, encouraging safety and security and licensing, where we can make sure that everybody's doing what they've been trained to do. And some of the responsible conduct best practices include making chassis, as they're called. These are biological organisms that we use in a laboratory, which are locked into the laboratory. They couldn't survive in the wild. We've tested them not just on paper, but in actual physically isolated communities, and that they can't exchange genetic material with the wild. So they're locked in with chemicals that only are produced in the laboratory, and they can't exchange material, genetic material.
A lot of people a few years ago said, didn't that Craig Venter and his team do so? That's the first time we heard about this synthetic biology. The question is, what did Craig Venter and his team do compared to the larger frame of what we're talking about?
Well, even before the Venter team made a bacterial genome, many people had made viral genomes, which are just as significant milestones. And just making a copy of a genome isn't necessarily of practical significance, nor is it something that tells you a great deal of biology as a learning experience.
So they decoded the DNA of various genomes, then basically retyped it into the computer and created it again.
Exactly. So they made a copy. It was significant that it was read in to the computer using state-of-the-art technology, and then read out of the computer. So reading would be sequencing, and then printed out with, at the time, conventional DNA synthesis methods. But what's more significant, what synthetic biology is really about, is changing the function. Sometimes it can just be changing one base pair in this vast ocean of millions to billions of base pairs can greatly change the function.
You've been listening to a 2012 TechNation interview with George Church, the author of Regenesis: How Synthetic Biology Will Reinvent Nature and Ourselves. He remains the Robert Winthrop Professor of Genetics at Harvard Medical School. After the interview, he was headed for a plane where he declared he would be programming a bacteria. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, Matt Ridley. He's been here before with Genome and the Rational Optimist. Today, we're talking about innovation and how it works, and also why it flourishes in freedom. Then we'll hear from TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft about his work with the COVID-19 Response Task Force, part of the XPRIZE Pandemic Alliance. Corporations, universities, and more are joining together in the effort.
TechNation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global. On the web at mindk.com.
And now, Matt Ridley. Well, Matt, welcome back to Tech Nation.
Moira, it's great to be on the show again.
Well, we're talking about how innovation works. And it occurs to me, if you take any human, there's the likelihood that innovation will break out.
Yes, I think innovation is one of those extraordinary features of human society that we have and other animals don't. Rabbits and rocks, they don't experience innovation. And actually, most of our ancestors didn't experience much innovation, whereas we experience it all the time. We expect it. It's a natural, and it's the fuel of our prosperity. It's where all the advantages of modern civilization have come from, of course.
Now, what's the difference between invention and innovation?
I think this is a really important distinction because invention is only a very small part of innovation. That is to say, coming up with a new prototype of an idea is one thing, but turning that prototype into something practical, affordable, and reliable is actually a big job, much bigger job than the original inventor usually appreciates. So he gets cross, that is, he doesn't get enough credit for it. There's a lovely story about Charles Townes, the inventor of the laser. He used to tell this story about a beaver talking to a rabbit looking at the Hoover Dam. And the beaver is saying to the rabbit, "No, I didn't build it myself, but it's based on an idea of mine." And I think this gets across quite nicely that you know, it's a big job turning an invention into an innovation.
And I think also the old adage of necessity is the mother of invention can't even begin to address all the innovation around us all the time.
The idea that necessity is the mother of invention, you can see what people are getting at, you know, that if you need to invent something, you have to. But actually, it doesn't really portray what happens in the real world, because otherwise societies that are desperate and impoverished would be more inventive than societies that are prosperous and happy. And on the whole, the opposite is true. If you look at the most inventive, innovative societies in the world developing the new technologies, they've tended to be prosperous trading cities, whether in China 1,000 years ago or in Italy 500 years ago or in the Netherlands and the Low Countries 300 years ago or then in Victorian Britain or then California. Innovation is kind of like a bushfire that flares up in some parts of the world at some times, much more than at others. It's often associated with trade, and it's often associated with relative prosperity. That is to say, people who are well off invest that capital in trying to find new ways of doing things and produce results that benefit everybody in the long run. But, you know, it's not necessity that's driving it, it's opportunity.
Interesting. Opportunity. It's not just about money, is it?
Well, I don't think innovation is just about money at all. In fact, it sometimes gets in the way. The whole patent system, the whole intellectual property system, is based around the idea that we need to reward people with a monopolistic ability to earn money from an innovation. And actually, history suggests it's not very effective. In fact, it can be very counterproductive in that respect, because what happens is that somebody invents something, they get a patent on it, they spend years fighting off other people who've got rival patents on a similar idea. They make a monopoly profit off it. They try not to invent something new to displace it, because then they've got to go through the whole cycle again. And it's when the patent expires that you get a burst of innovation. A very good example of this is the 3D printing patents, which expired, some key patents expired 4 years ago. And the consequence was a great burst of innovation, which brought the price of 3D printing right down. The point of innovation is to get the price down. So the point of innovation, in a sense, is to save money, is to make new technologies available to pretty well everybody.
And we have to be really clear. So many people think that we sit around Silicon Valley inventing things. So many times, someone or some group looks at something someone else has invented or a concept someone else has, and they take it from point A to point B. That's what really drives the innovation. And we don't even have to talk about today. I'm thinking of your example of Lady Mary Pierpoint.
Lady Mary Pierpoint is just a lovely example of someone who's not an inventor, but she's an innovator. She's a feisty, powerful, literary woman who marries a rather dull man in a rather dramatic way. She elopes with him, but he turns out to be boring all the same. But anyway, he becomes the British ambassador to Constantinople, and she goes with him. And while she's there, she discovers this extraordinary habit that the women have in Ottoman society, which is that they deliberately give a little bit of smallpox from someone who's recovered to a child, and that makes the child immune. This is inoculation or variolation, later known as vaccination. And she brings that idea back to Britain. She vaccinates her own children. She persuades people, including the Prince of Wales, to vaccinate his children. And this is incredibly unpopular. The medical profession says this is a disastrous idea. How dare you do something so dangerous? She's, besieged by critics for this. And something similar happens in North America around the same time. Now, she didn't invent it. She got it from the Ottomans. But where did they get it from? Well, we think they probably got it from China, but possibly Africa. The origins of these things are often lost in the mists of time. And then she didn't perfect it either, because a generation later, Edward Jenner, also in Britain, came up with the idea that actually all you need to do is give cowpox to people and then they'll be protected against smallpox. So he invented what, strictly speaking, became vaccination. So it's everybody is standing on the shoulders of their predecessors, and everybody is passing the idea on to their successors. And that's why it's sometimes unfair to single someone out and say, this is the inventor of X, because the more you look at it, the more you find he or she depended on some predecessor coming up with an idea and just building on it, just incrementally improving it. It's a surprisingly gradual, incremental process, innovation.
But there's a lot of human interconnection moving around. Many people listening do not even remember the first Macintosh, which is the mother, if you will, of all the graphical interfaces we have on all of their computers. And, this was fantastic. Well, of course, Steve Jobs got that by one visit to Xerox PARC Research Center. That's what they had.
Right.
It was like, what a good idea. Here we go. It was all born.
Well, I think Steve Jobs is another good example of an innovator. I don't think, again, one could necessarily describe him as an inventor so much as an innovator, because he's pulling together ideas from different people and in different places and making something pretty special. In the book, and relying very much on a wonderful book called The Innovators by Walter Isaacson, I posed the question, who invented the computer? And it's an amazingly difficult question to answer, actually, because if you go back, you've got to consider that there's a very advanced mechanical computer at Harvard called the Mark I, which has a claimed to be the first computer. But then there's the ENIAC in Philadelphia that has a sort of somewhat better claim because it's electronic, which the Mark I isn't, but it doesn't have stored programs the way the Mark I does. And anyway, both of them are incomplete, but both came out of ideas connected with what a computer might be that were sort of theoretical ideas that occurred to people like Johnny von Neumann and others, lots of others. In fact, you know, we ought to be able to say who invented the computer. I mean, it's not that long ago. It's obvious history. And yet nobody deserves the credit, because lots of people deserve the credit and they all get put together. And some very, very talented women basically came up with most of the ingredients of software, particularly things like subroutines. Grace Hopper is a good example of one of them.
Now, early on in the book, you write, innovation is the most important fact about the modern world, but one of the least well understood. Now, how so, the most important fact about the modern world? How do you argue that?
Well, I think to explain almost anything that's going on, whether it's what's happening in our politics with respect to social media, or whether it's with respect to warfare and nuclear weapons, or any of the big themes of the last 50 years are the result of one innovation or another. I mean, it's absolutely central to what we are and what we do. For example, the invention of radio, the medium we're using at the moment in the 1920s, played a pretty large role in the rise of the dictators and the descent into war. Now, it may not have been the main or only cause, but it was a contributor. Likewise, the invention of television seems to have had the opposite effect. It sort of dragged us back to a mushy middle where we all agreed with each other a bit. Then along comes the internet and social media, and many of us think it's going to be utopian and that we are going to see each other's point of view, and suddenly kumbaya, harmony is going to break out. Didn't work out that way, did it? And then if you take the same analogy back to the 1500s and look at the invention of printing, the great printing innovator, by far the most effective user of printing and the most published author, is a man named Martin Luther, who's using this technology to change the world in terms of religion. And it is not trivial to say that the religious wars of the 1600s and 1500s came out of printing. So technological change can have an enormous impact. And so, of course, can social change. I mean, innovation isn't just about things. It's about institutions and people and habits and ideas, too.
Now, the second part of that is innovation is one of the least well understood. We've distinguished it from invention. What else about innovation do people generally not understand? Or people, how about organizations? How about governments not understand?
Well, on the whole, we think that innovation is something that happens suddenly. Goes in leaps. We call it disruptive. That's generally not true. It's mostly incremental. We tend to think we can force it. We can tell it what to come up with. That tends to be not true as well. For example, in the last 50 years, we've been unable to innovate much in transport. You know, we're still going around in cars and planes that go at the same speed as they did 50 years ago. Whereas in the previous 50 years, we had extraordinary changes in transport. We had flight and space travel and things like that for the first time. By contrast, in my lifetime, I've lived through incredible innovation in computers and communications, but my grandparents didn't. They had the telephone when they were born and they had the telephone when they died. So we don't understand why that is. Why should one technology have advanced in the first half of the 20th century and the other in the second half of the 20th century? We don't understand. We misunderstand where it comes from. We think innovation comes out of science, out of knowledge. And that's not always true. It can be true, but it's just as often true that knowledge comes out of innovation, that you get tinkering engineers changing the world, and that results in better understanding of the world. So, for example, the steam engine leads to the science of thermodynamics rather than the other way around. And there's a very nice example of this that I like to cite, which is CRISPR, the new technology for genome editing, which is changing the world of agricultural research, but also medicine. And this looks like a purely theoretical discovery in universities that then gets applied in the real world. But when you look further back, you find that the universities got this from the yogurt industry, which was trying to understand how bacteria got sick when they were attacked by viruses. And they discovered this immune system within bacteria, which turned out to have a way of very precisely zeroing in on particular gene sequences, which could be adapted. So academia and universities have a much more reciprocal relationship in this respect, I think, than we often give it credit for. So there's all sorts of things that we misunderstand about innovation, but there's other things that we still don't understand.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Matt Ridley. You likely know him from his many books, including Genome, Nature Via Nurture, and The Rational Optimist, or from contributions to The Wall Street Journal or The Times, or as we say, The Times of London, where he writes on science, the environment, and economics. He's here today with how innovation works and why it flourishes in freedom. Now, we just left with you saying, well, you know, there are things we don't understand about innovation. And I've learned, well, I'm shy about asking that question because I had Sir Francis Crick on, who wrote a book about, you know, the scientific search for the soul. And I'm speaking with him about that. And he goes, well, we've got this and we've got that. But we really don't understand everything. And I said, well, could you characterize what we don't understand? And there was a little silence. And he said, if I knew what was missing, I would have put it in the book. So I don't know. Should I ask you, what do you think? Do you have anything? What don't we understand?
Well, I wrote a biography of Francis Crick, so I'm familiar with his formidable style of interviewing. And I interviewed him a few months before his death. And you didn't get away with a stupid question.
Oh, yeah? Okay. Keep going, man. I got some questions here.
I come back to this, in terms of things we don't understand, I come back to this question of why it happens when and where it does. Because it's not as if innovation is happening everywhere in the world at the same time. There are periods when it happens in one place and periods when it happens in another. You know, I don't think you would call Italy the center of global innovation today, but in the 1400s, it certainly was. All sorts of ferment of new ideas coming out of there, including, for example, zero and the Indian numerals, which a wonderful mathematician named Fibonacci brought to Europe. Now, that's an innovation, not an invention, because he got it from the Arabs and the Arabs got it from the Indians. But, why there? Why then? And why California? Why Victorian Britain? You know, why these places? So I think there's a lot of the sort of geopolitics of innovation that we don't fully understand. And it would be nice to be able to predict where it... Here's another thing that we don't understand. Why is innovation very obvious in retrospect and very unpredictable when you're looking forward? So 21 different people came up with the idea of the light bulb in the 1870s simultaneously, independently, basically. Thomas Edison and Joseph Swan, Lodygin in Russia, you know, all these people. And that was because the idea was ripe. It was ready to go. The ability to create a vacuum, the ability to blow glass, the ability to use electricity for lighting. These had all come together and it was inevitable that people would invent light bulbs. And you can't rerun the tape without Edison or Swan or someone and you'd still have light bulbs. And the same in the 1990s with search engines. If Larry Page had never met Sergey Brin, we would still have search engines. We had search engines before Google. It's just they came up with a particularly good one. So the search engine is inevitable then. It's ripe, it's ready. But did anyone see it coming? No. Actually, there are one or two prescient remarks from earlier in the world of computing, but amazingly few. And most people, even Brin and Page, didn't realize that's what they were inventing. They thought they were cataloging the internet. They didn't spot search as the, you know, the most profitable, the most lucrative, the most ubiquitous. I think it's one of the great inventions of my lifetime, the search engine. I use it pretty well every day in one form or another. And yet nobody saw it coming. Why is that? Why is it so hard? These things look so obvious when you're looking backwards, but they are very hard to see when you're looking forwards.
Well, I'm sitting in the middle of Silicon Valley, and you know, we eat innovation for breakfast, right next to a good helping of failure. But we also have success, and we know about the role of serendipity, the best example being the people who have had a great success, realizing later on that they were actually a hair's breadth close to failure, and incorporate all of that experience in their next effort. I mean, there is the who happened to meet who when and things that fall into your lap. I don't know if that's just how life is or if that's part of that magical thing that we call innovation when it's successful, because there are people to trade with around and there's new people coming in and new things coming in so that the serendipity can happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's fascinating how many innovations happened to people looking for something else. So there's a woman named Stephanie Kwolek discovered Kevlar while working at DuPont. Art Fry developed the Post-it note at 3M. They were both looking for something else. In the case of the Post-it note, they were looking for a permanent glue, and they found a temporary glue, and they thought, well, that's useless. And then Art Fry went off to sing in his choir, and he thought, hang on, this could be quite useful for marking my place in my hymn book. And so he applied some to the back of some yellow bits of paper, and the rest is history. So that those are nice examples of serendipity. And as you say, often it comes from the combination, from ideas coming from different people and coming together. In the 18th century in Britain, there was this thing called the Longitude Prize, which was £20,000 to the first person who could determine, who could measure longitude when you're at sea, which is very difficult. And the result came, the winner was a clockmaker who said, well, actually, all you need is an extremely robust clock that doesn't mind being bobbing about on the waves, that can tell you what the time in London is, and you can compare it with the time where you are, and that will tell you how far west you are. And everyone said, well, it can't be that easy. It must be something to do with astronomy or something. But of course, he was right. And even if you look, there are sites today, there's a site called Innocentive where companies can go and post problems saying, we can't crack this problem. Can anyone come up with an idea? An analysis suggests that most of the ideas come from unexpected directions.
You've been listening to Matt Ridley, the author of How Innovation Works and Why It Flourishes in Freedom. We'll continue after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation are available on NPR One, Apple iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Direct links are available at technation.com. In the second half of our show, Tech Nation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about the XPRIZE Pandemic Alliance and its COVID-19 Response Task Force. Stay with us.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Matt Ridley, the author of How Innovation Works and Why It Flourishes in Freedom.
Most of the ideas come from unexpected directions. So it really does, you know, to be good at innovation, you've got to be open to thoughts coming from unexpected directions. And you've got to be talking to other people. I mean, if you try and innovate on your own in secret, it won't work. It's a much more collaborative process. Good example of that is a man named Samuel Langley, who got an enormous grant from the US government to build a flying machine in 1903. He was the head of the Smithsonian. He was an astronomer. He was extremely distinguished. But he set about it by building the whole machine at once without testing any of the bits of it and with keeping the whole idea secret. And he then launched it off a houseboat on the Potomac and it in front of a huge crowd, and it went 20 feet and nosedived into the water. And about 10 days later, on an island off North Carolina, two humble bicycle-making brothers from Dayton, Ohio, achieved what he had failed to achieve, which was powered flight, the Wright brothers. Nobody believed them for years because they couldn't, you know, they weren't grand enough. But what they had done is quite different. They tested all the different elements separately. They tested the wings, the tail, the curvature of the wings. They'd done experiments in wind tunnels. They'd corresponded with absolutely everybody in the world who was thinking about flight, people who were building gliders and so on. So they'd drawn on as many directions as possible, and they'd left the easy bit till last, which was the engine. They said all the engine has to do is power. So all we need is a lightweight engine. And this is a nice example. There's a guy at Google who says this is called the monkey first principle, which is if you are going to innovate by teaching a monkey to recite Shakespeare while standing on a pedestal, don't invent the pedestal first. Make sure you've invented the monkey first.
Well, I see.
And that, the Wright brothers did that.
They hire interesting people at Google, don't they?
They do
indeed.
It's a strange metaphor, but it kind of works.
It works. I won't be putting it up in my kitchen, but I'll. That's okay. Well, you don't just talk about the successes and the processes. You also talk about frauds and fakers. Then we're used to failures, but frauds and fakers, let's talk about that.
I know, because, I mean, there's honest failures, you know. People like Edison and Jeff Bezos are extremely keen on pointing out that they did a lot of failure to get to their success. So there's, you know, failure mustn't be a disaster. But there are also people who came up with ideas, pursued them relentlessly, managed to get an enormous amount of funding for them, and were just wrong. You know, it never happened. It never came together and it didn't work. And either they were fraudulent in some cases and knew perfectly well that they were ripping off their investors, or in some cases they were just bullheaded and optimistic and wrong. There's a saying in Silicon Valley, I'm sure you know it well, which is fake it till you make it. But I mean, if you look at Steve Jobs's career, there's an element of that. He would announce products that he didn't yet know how to produce because he could challenge his colleagues to meet that goal. And it often worked. Now, the reason it worked was because of Moore's law, because of the incredible improvements that were happening in computing and silicon and so on at the time, so that you could predict that things were going to get better and we're going to be able to crack this problem. And the way Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes's company, got into trouble more recently was by trying the same trick with a technology which wasn't seeing these improvements. Because the beauty of transistors is that the smaller you make them, the more reliable they are, as well as the cheaper. But that, of course, is not true of microfluidics and blood tests. The smaller the sample, the harder it is to test blood. And so Theranos got into trouble because it kept promising products and failing to deliver. But it nonetheless became a darling of Silicon Valley, huge investment, $9 billion valuation at one stage. In the end, it didn't have the technology to match.
But to be clear, that money did not come out of Silicon Valley. There was a lot of East Coast money that had never been in the tech field before. There weren't tech people on their board. If you look pretty clearly, because it couldn't pass the Silicon Valley test.
Yes, I think you're right there. But it is it's a pretty spectacular example of
I'll give you that.
I mean, the other one that I write about in the book is the fake bomb detectors, which evolved out of a completely fraudulent device that was intended to enable golfers to find lost golf balls, and they never worked, and they were just a pure fraud, and it was eventually exposed, but not before a lot of people had died.
Now, in the area of public health, you also write about the polio virus, which was so familiar to me in terms of growing up, but is also familiar today, considering, you know, just how frightened we are for everyone and how frightened we are for our children, et cetera. Let's talk about that story of the polio virus.
Yes, I think this is one of the remarkable stories and a very happy ending, but with some uncomfortable moments along the way. Because the rise of polio as a crippling disease for particularly young people, which got worse and worse as the 20th century went on, became a huge cause for lots of charities and others to try and put money into research to try and find a vaccine for polio in the 1950s, and it was the golden fleece. It was the thing that everybody wanted to find, and so there was a lot of haste, a lot of competition, a lot of desperation to be right and to get this right. There were unfortunate mistakes made along the way. There was an early version of the Salk vaccine was badly manufactured in such a way that it actually caused polio rather than preventing it. Many people actually got it as a result from a batch that was made by Cutter Laboratories on the West Coast. But I write in the book about a rather splendid woman called Bernice Eddy, who discovered that vaccines such as the polio vaccine were contaminated with a virus from monkeys called SV40, which was capable of causing cancer. And she makes this argument and is basically fired for rocking the boat and for spoiling the story that this is all going to be marvelous. But she persists, and she's absolutely right. It doesn't seem to have caused an epidemic of human cancer, although it can't be ruled out that it may have contributed. But it was an example of, on the whole, the polio vaccine was a tremendously good thing. It has got to the within an inch of eliminating polio from the world. I mean, it's now gone from Africa, but there are still a few cases in Pakistan. And that's incredible, when you think how widespread it was before that, which is all great. But along the way, harm was done. And we have to remember that even though you do good with innovation, you can also do harm.
Well, you mentioned Pakistan, and that reminds me, in the United States, we can choose between genetically modified food and organic food, or non-genetically modified food, if you will. Even though there are no labels on it, a genetically modified food is not permitted in the UK, where you are right now. And yet, the impact globally on genetically engineered food, I find it to be a very interesting and very extensive topic. Let's talk about the impact of engineered crops in India and Pakistan.
Yes, well, particularly with respect to things like cotton, I think the best of the genetically modified things is a thing called BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, which is it started out as a bacterium that was used by organic farmers to defeat insects. It's a bacterium that is toxic to insects. It kills insects. And by extracting the gene from the bacterium that kills insects and putting it into plants, you can make plants that are insect resistant but completely harmless for people. And because this was already an organic pesticide, you'd think that it would be very welcome. But in fact, there was a lot of resistance to it. In India and Pakistan in particular, it's been used in cotton. So most cotton is now grown with this, because the problem with insects that attack cotton, like the boll weevil, is that they live inside the cotton boll. And so it's very hard to get at them by spraying on the outside. But if the plant is producing something that the insect doesn't like, then the plant is protected. And this is a nice case where this product wasn't allowed, this seed wasn't allowed in India, but a black market developed because people could see that this was a fantastically good product. It was well protected against insects, and it was much cheaper to grow and produce better results. And so the farmers themselves led the way to changing the minds of the country about growing this product. And that today there are arguments also about BT brinjal, eggplant, and various other crops. It's a very important area. And on the whole, there is no doubt now that genetically modified crops are doing huge benefit to the environment, because they're enabling us to use fewer insecticides and to actually use less land, less water, and that kind of thing.
Well, you write that history shows that innovation is a delicate flower, easily crushed underfoot, but to regrow if conditions will allow. Well, certainly today we're in the midst of the COVID-19 crisis, and taking the scientists and engineers focused on this aspect of the situation, everyone else, if they're lucky, was either sent home to work from home, but millions of others have lost their jobs or wonder if they will have them when they return. And if I read your observations correctly, and we're thinking about recovering from this pandemic for however long it takes, will that take a toll on innovation? Is that right?
Well, obviously, any setback to the world economy is a disaster for innovation and for technology, as well as for everything else. But my view is that the pandemic will alert us to the need for more innovation, because we're looking at vaccine development and finding that it's hardly changed. I mean, I write in the book about two wonderful women, Grace Eldering and Pearl Kendrick, who invented the whooping cough vaccine in the 1930s. And they took about 4 years to go from first idea to a working vaccine. Well, that's not much longer than it would take today to develop a vaccine. And isn't that rather shocking that we've seen so little progress in innovation in vaccine development? And I think that has to change. Likewise, a new medical device takes 2 or 3 years to get approved in most Western countries. And that is deterring people from trying to invent these things. If that hadn't been the case, if we'd been getting quicker decisions out of regulators, then I think we'd have more point-of-care diagnostic tests to use during an epidemic like this. So the epidemic is reminding us of the need for innovation to solve this problem. The Ebola epidemic caused quite a lot of research into antiviral chemicals, some of which I think are going to be quite promising against COVID-19. So it might, you know, we may yet defeat this disease with a drug rather than a vaccine. You know, we haven't yet been able to defeat viruses on the same way that we defeat bacteria with antibiotics. So I think there will be a stimulus to innovation in the medical field, but I also hope that it results in us thinking about the need to stimulate innovation generally, because if all those people who have lost their jobs need to get back to work, then the way to do that is to generate prosperity, and the way to do that is to come up with innovation. I very strongly argue in the book that innovation does not destroy jobs. We've been worried about this for 200 years, but we've automated agriculture, we've automated most of manufacturing to a huge degree, and yet there are more people in work than ever before, and that's because through innovation we invent new roles, new jobs, new things that we're capable of doing, as well as the prosperity to pay for them. So, you know, if you said to a Victorian engineer, would you rather be a flight attendant or a software engineer, he wouldn't know what you were talking about. Neither profession existed 150 years ago. So I do think that the way we're going to recover the world economy is by unleashing innovation and bringing prosperity to everyone. I give one example in the book that I think stands out for me more than every other of an innovation that is done right and done well and has done good. And it's the insecticide-treated mosquito bed net. This has turned around the malaria story. Malaria was increasing till 2003. It's now rapidly decreasing as a cause of death. That's largely because of this simple technology, championed by the Gates Foundation, who are spreading it around Africa. And it turns out, because of some very nice experiments done in Burkina Faso in the 1980s, that these things deter mosquitoes as well as kill them. And that therefore, this has saved millions of lives, and nobody's made a profit out of it. Nobody's patented it. It's a very simple, it's a low tech thing. There's no electronics involved. It just shows what we can do when we put our minds to it as a species.
Well, we haven't gotten to a lot, like the fact that you're a member of the House of Lords, your Lord somebody or other. We haven't given full disclosure to your quote on the front of my long ago book, calling me a gonzo storyteller. Hunter S. Thompson meets Richard Feynman. I'm still living up to both. We haven't gotten to your TED talk about when ideas have sex. I'm afraid we've just run out of time. But I do hope, Matt, you'll come back and see us again.
Moira, it's been a huge pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
My guest today is Matt Ridley. His book is How Innovation Works and Why It Flourishes in Freedom. It's published by Harper. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. While we turn from one person to another, one organization to another, one anything to another, there is still the power of working together. TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft is leading the COVID-19 Response Task Force, which is part of the XPRIZE Pandemic Alliance. Well, Daniel, welcome back.
Great to be back.
Now, I want to ask you about something called the XPRIZE Pandemic Alliance. We're all familiar with XPRIZE. You've been involved with the XPRIZE for years in many of its different variations. Remind us what XPRIZE is and what this XPRIZE Pandemic Alliance is.
So the XPRIZE was founded, I think, 15 or 16 years ago by Dr. Peter Diamandis. And the idea was to prize challenges that were audacious but possible and encourage and incentivize folks to solve those challenges, the first one being the Ansari XPRIZE to get a non-NASA or government rocket to space. And that's now catalyzed the whole space industry from SpaceX to Jeff Bezos doing Blue Origin and beyond. And there's been many versions of XPRIZE. I've been involved in the coming up with the tricorder XPRIZE to make home-based diagnostic devices, kind of a la Star Trek. But in the challenging era of COVID and our pandemic era here in early 2020, the XPRIZE has catalyzed a new alliance called the XPRIZE Pandemic Alliance, and I'm lucky to chair the alliance task force with the goal of bringing together university partners, corporate partners, NGOs, and the general public to help solve for the challenges we have in addressing COVID-19 and hopefully preventing future pandemics.
So there may be multiple challenges under the XPRIZE Pandemic Alliance.
Exactly. And it's not starting out as a bunch of prizes to start with. We're now basically trying to pull together all these amazing groups, all the sort of thousands of flowers that are blooming, trying to solve PPE shortages and new drugs and vaccines and social network support in new ways, because there's a lot of amazing things happening. And part of the challenge is to connect the dots and catalyze faster, better solutions rather than everyone, trying to do this in parallel. So I'll try and give you a few examples. I was just on a what we call a jam session today, where we're having folks looking at generating a new therapy. So it could be a drug therapy. And here in, spring of 2020, we're still in the early days of developing drugs for coronavirus. And most of them are for patients who are in the intensive care unit on a ventilator. Some of the trials are showing that they might shorten the course by a few days and lower mortality by a few percentage points. They're certainly not blockbusters or solving things. What do we think about treating patients early? How do we triage a patient? As many folks who get coronavirus, they do fine. They're not going to feel great, but they don't end up in the hospital. How do we start to triage them early? How do you think about treating them before they need oxygen or a ventilator? How do we roll out those clinical trials and connect the dots? How do we send folks home maybe with a little telemedicine kit, a pulse oximeter, or the equivalent of that tricorder to measure their oxygen levels? And if they're going in the wrong direction, have them develop a clinical trial kit at home to start taking, whether it's something like hydroxychloroquine, which hasn't panned out for very sick patients very well.
Probably won't be in the kit, but
yeah.
Could be.
But
yeah.
The trials for that, frankly, have only looked at the sicker patients. How do you start to think about, you know, we're all familiar with the common flu. There's a drug called Tamiflu, which does not work for coronavirus, by the way. But when you have an early on in your course of the common flu, if you take that drug, it shortens the course. So it's not for the super sick, but for preventing it early on. Could we find those drugs early? And how do we create the connections between academic groups, telemedicine providers, big data folks, so that we can do those sorts of trials at scale? That's one example. We need to think a lot about, as we try and get back to normal life, how do we test people? There's all these immunologic tests, measuring your your IgG and IgM. How do we validate those? How do we help the folks who are developing those tests get them out and deliver them? How do we lower the socioeconomic barrier? So part of what we're doing with this alliance is connecting the dots. Anthem is one of the major partners, and through that is creating a XPRIZE Pandemic Alliance data collective where folks can donate their data, whether it's Anthem data, anonymized data about thousands of patients over years, or IBM, who's one of the partners, can be potentially blending their abilities to do machine learning and AI on that. We've got universities from UCI and UCLA doing trials and contributing their data sets. So, and we're hoping to open up those data sets for challenges as this moves on. So the bottom line is we have a huge short-term, long-term challenge with this pandemic and potentially future ones. We need to collaborate in new ways, and this alliance is one way to start connecting the dots.
One of the things I like about this is that you're bringing together a whole lot of people who, well, in many sense, don't have any skin in the game, but got all their skin in the game. They're trying to work here. Once you can get the right number of people there to coalesce, to see how to formulate challenges as to what would move things forward and what the appropriate parameters can be, the XPRIZE expertise is creating such challenges and funding them and managing them and seeing them through. Because that's an expertise in itself that I don't know of another institution, or I don't know if we want to call it an institution, an entity that has that ability to bring it together, to execute it. Mm-hmm. Other, you see individual ones say, well, this is really down our alley and we're going to give a prize if somebody can do that. This is a whole process that says, we can do this. Once you got it formulated, we can fund it, we can collect it, we can monitor it, we can make sure that it's fair and make sure that they reach their goals. And that actually moves things forward. So it gives me some hope. It's not just, we're going to get together and talk about it. No, we've got an ability here to bring it to action.
Yeah, and I think part of that is finding sort of market failures. I don't think we need to have a prize around a new vaccine. There's lots of folks working on the vaccine itself, but there might be a prize about how do you distribute that once it's discovered? Or how do we take lessons? Some of the amazing folks on our task force include Dr. Sam Broder, who used to be the head of the National Cancer Institute, who was very involved in the early solutions for HIV, from AZT to the cocktails. So how might we... I'm making this up right now, do a challenge around building the cocktail of therapies that might be needed to treat the coronavirus, COVID-19 virus, which might not respond to just one drug, but need a similar type approach. How do we integrate in design thinking? The folks from IDEO or in part of the alliance, they're a master at design thinking and solutions that connect dots, because you need to think about a patient journey. It's not just about a drug or a device or a ventilator, but how do you then manage that patient, for example, once they've gotten out of the intensive care unit? I'm an oncologist. We know that many cancer patients have a lot of downstream issues from chemotherapy and radiation. That's going to be the case also for coronavirus patients, unfortunately, who've been through the ringer. And we need to think about managing that and maybe prizes around understanding those comorbidities and how to address them. So it's a real opportunity to kind of bring that hive mind together, both across the alliance, but then across hopefully future challenges.
Well, this is a really good point. I mean, when we were talking about prizes that could result in commercialization to solve a sticky problem, then the money was really good because you could take it and then move it into commercialization. But there are a lot of things that create value, a lot of recognitions, a whole lot of things that could be the reward having done it, or the ability to work on it some more. There's any number of ways that we can have rewards and prices that aren't just specifically money. Sometimes it's opportunity. You can reward with opportunity, as an example.
And one of the opportunities from the pandemic crisis is that we're getting folks who are cross-collaborating, who never used to, you know, live in the same world, from companies like NVIDIA to IBM, cross-fertilizing with, you know, UCLA or YPO or, you know, small healthcare startups that are doing telemedicine that can find, you know, solutions that are working at maybe small scale and then really amplify them. Also, a lot of it, I think a lot about the solutions and opportunity is finding, just like an XPRIZE does, a novel solution and then scaling it so that it makes a big impact sooner rather than later.
It's clear to me that it's really impacting the innovation ecosystem in a whole new way.
Yeah, and the idea of prizes isn't new. In fact, what inspired the foundation of XPRIZE was the fact that Charles Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic, not just for kicks, but to win a monetary prize. So, and it, again, not all prizes are monetary. I think in this era of crowdsourcing, you can build all sorts of micro incentives for folks to donate their data, to collaborate. And XPRIZE is a great example of that convergence. And it's going to be really interesting to see some of the projects and solutions that come out by sharing data, resources, ideas. Again, not just for the immediate term of this COVID-19 crisis, but how do we get to recovery? How do we prevent future elements? One idea that I'm spinning up is the concept that in the future, we recognize the importance of public health, but we can't necessarily have a huge army of public health workers waiting around for the next pandemic. We all want to think about the potential of maybe having a global public health core, just like folks are trained as volunteer EMTs and firefighters in towns where there's not a full-time force. What if we could have folks, just like you're trained in CPR, to learn some public health skills and be part of contact tracing when you need to track someone down and put out those small fires before they become a full-on forest fire?
Well, Daniel, thanks for coming in. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me. Stay safe.
TechNation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft is the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. More information about the XPRIZE Pandemic Alliance and the COVID-19 Response Task Force can be found at xprize.org/fight-COVID-19. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BioTechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BioTechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.